Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is Keith Boykin, a TV commentator, author, motivational speaker, and an amazing man in many ways. Keith went to school at Dartmouth, was educated at Dartmouth and Harvard, attended law school with President Barack Obama, and served in the White House as a special assistant to Bill Clinton, where he helped organize and participated in the nation's first ever meeting between a sitting president and leaders of the GLBT community. His latest book, For Colored Boys Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Still Not Enough, is a collection of 44 stories of men of color coming of age, coming out, and coming home to their families and communities. Good evening, Keith. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing great.
Good to be here.
Yeah, good to be doing this. Big question. What brought you to write this book right now? You're a political commentator. You're on MSNBC. CNBC, we've seen you on CNN in the past, BET networks, a lot of social activism. You've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people. What made you write this book now?
Well, I think there was a need for it. You know, the book's title is For Colored Boys Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Still Not Enough. And I think there was something in the community that seemed to suggest that it was important. I mean, there was a rash of suicides that took place just a couple of years ago. They started to get reported among African-American, Latino youth, many of whom were LGBT or considered to be LGBT or subjected to anti-gay bullying. And I thought it was important to talk about that because it was being underreported in the media. And so we brought together a collection of 40-some-odd people to help tell those stories.
And it really is amazing. It's an incredible book. It actually moved me more than the It Gets Better thing because it felt more real just reading their stories. I'm going to do a quote from your introduction that just I have stuck on my wall. And it says, "It should come as no surprise to anyone who has followed the news that our society has a tendency to dismiss the grievous experiences of young men of color." I just find that amazing when I read that in the 21st century.
It is amazing, and yet it's not surprising. You know, I think back again to the whole situation with Trayvon Martin in Florida and how people just kind of pick sides over who they would believe and who they wouldn't believe in terms of what to think about this young man. And then I think about the Down Low storyline that happened just a few years ago, and I wrote my last book about that, where these young black men were being portrayed as demons and predators who, because they were allegedly passing on HIV/AIDS to innocent, unsuspecting women. And it's just a pattern that goes on and on from one example to the next in which black men are treated differently or viewed differently by society. I experience it every time I try to pick up a cab in Washington, D.C., which for some reason is the hardest place to get a cab.
and you know, missing and exploited children, you never see a black male. And you know there has to be, you know, in this country, dozens of African American and Latino young males and females that are missing. And I've not seen any on my milk cartons, you know. Go ahead.
And black men are more likely to be victims of crime, which sometimes doesn't get discussed because people are always portray black men as the perpetrators of crime, but we're also more likely to be the victims of crime. And it's almost as if that's not important. You know, there's a lot of shootings that have taken place in the city of Chicago over the course of the past year or so that have been reported a great deal in Chicago and to a certain extent somewhat outside of Chicago, but there really hasn't been a great deal of engagement, I think, to sort of address this as some sort of crisis that deserves national attention, that deserves some sort of concerted effort to respond to it. It's almost like we expect young black men to kill themselves, to take it out on one another, and we don't really want to do anything about it. So I think the reason why this book is so important is not just for young black men or even young Latino or Asian men, but it's just the idea that there are stories out there that are not being told. Real life stories, people coming of age, coming out, dealing with sexual abuse and molestation, dealing with HIV/AIDS, dealing with love and relationships, and finding their way through their families when their families are not always accepting, and negotiating through their spirituality and their faith when their churches are not always the most welcoming. And those stories deserve to be told.
Exactly. It's interesting, from just in history, the African American churches have been, you know, the shelter, the sanctuary, the safe space for the African American community over the last since the Civil War, actually, probably. And it seems like it's not the case if you're fit outside the norm in sexuality, both in gender orientation and gender expression, because I think that's something that was very telling in these stories.
Yeah, I think that these stories, first of all, the stories represent a broad range of different perspectives and backgrounds. They're not just my story. I couldn't have put together this book if it was just my story, because some of the experiences that people shared were so different from anything I'd ever experienced. But secondly, I think that the broad range of experiences comes from the diversity of people who are represented. You have people who are young and old, people who come from all different parts of the country, people who are have different economic and socioeconomic backgrounds as well. So naturally, the stories they're going to tell are going to reflect their varied experiences, and some of them are very sad, I have to say. Some of them are triumphant, but all of them, I think, leave you with at least some glimmer of hope that in spite of all the turmoil and travails that people may face, that there's still some hope out there that that something can be done. And you know, one of the things I'll just add real quickly about the whole "It Gets Better" campaign. Two of the essays in the book actually address the "It Gets Better" campaign, and they do so in a little bit of a different way, because I think at least one essay, for example, Kenyon Farrell, he talks about this, and he says that instead of just saying "it gets better," I think we have an obligation to make it better. It's not enough, for example, for a young person who is contemplating suicide just to know that at some point in the future, 20 years later or so, they might have a better life. From what I'm told, people who are at that point of contemplating suicide or taking their own life are often at the place where they don't feel like they can think through tomorrow or the next day, or definitely not the next month. They can't imagine what that's like. So I think we have an obligation not just to promise them that things will get better in the future, but an obligation and responsibility to make things better right now.
Right. For those of you who want to know some of the literary mechanics of this book, there are quite a few poems in the book, which is kind of a surprise. And one of the poets is Keith himself. I didn't. Another one of your amazing talents. How did you get to be a poet?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a poet unless you say anyone who writes poetry is a poet, but I'm not a professional poet. I decided that I wanted to write a piece at the end of the book to bring together all the various themes and ideas that were incorporated in the book. And I wrote a piece inside the book called Dare to Be Powerful, or When I Dare to Be Powerful, which is about the Million Man March and my experience with that. But I wanted something to just sort of wrap it all up. And I couldn't think of a way to do it in prose, so I felt that poetry might be the most appropriate way. Sometimes poetry has a way of reaching people in a way that just reading an essay cannot. So I was hoping that would accomplish that. The funny thing is, after I finished the book, a few months after I finished the book, I was cleaning out my computer cache and I came across some old pieces I'd written. I found a poem I had written years ago. I'm going to have to step away just for a second, if you don't mind. I'm going to have to take care of this real quickly, but I will be right back. Hold on.
Okay. Caller 410, you're on the air. Keith, had to go wait for a moment. How are you? Hello.
I know that was really weird. ironically enough, I happened to order takeout about 45 minutes ago, and I thought it would have been here by now, but unfortunately it just now came. So,
I have a hungry guest tonight.
Yeah, I came from the gym, and I've been working, covering the campaign and everything. But yeah, so the thing I was trying to tell you about the poetry real quickly, I'm going to have to step away again, so hopefully you have something to say for a moment when I do. The thing I was trying to tell you about the poetry is that I came across a poem that I had written years ago that I did not realize I had written. I'd forgotten about it because it was about 10 years old or so. And I think it would have been a very appropriate poem to include in the section on love, but I didn't come across it until after the book was done.
Oh, my God. I don't see how you keep anything in order. Anyway, okay, let me just... I'm going to
step away while you do that.
Okay, I'm going to read from one of the poems in the book. Not Keith. There are several poems in the book. Hassan Bea, and for colored boys trapped in the windowless, isolated boxes of limited opportunity, with restless souls and deferred dreams, seeking love in unromantic late-night cyber encounters, and journey unprotected through the wilderness of instant gratification, finding peace in death, but never in life. To colored boys who have never been offered a hand to hold or a shoulder to cry on, who tell narratives that go unheard, who have
ears and
who have needs that go unrealized, and who give rarely, get anything in return. I just read part of one of the poems, that's fine. Incredible stuff. I think what I realized in reading it, I am admitting that I have grown up pretty much isolated in the white privileged world. I'm from Kansas. I moved to Florida 12 years ago. And I didn't really give much thought to African-American male gay role models. You're the big one here. We'll talk about tonight. But I know most young boys. I have a 37-year-old son, and I remember him growing up. So sports heroes were the number one role models in his life growing up: baseball, football, soccer, whatever. And you almost get a homophobic vibe from sports today. Did you find that true?
I think that's true. I don't think it's just today. I think that maybe there's some sort of cultural phenomenon that makes it more pronounced today. But I think sports, you know, has always been sort of that one area where people have been afraid to come out. You have very few athletes who have come out over the years. And, you know, I don't think that's unusual. I think that it's a reflection of the times, if you will, that we discuss it more. But we have a whole section in the book, actually a whole piece in the book, where a number of athletes actually do come out, including DeMarco Majors, who's a basketball player who talks about his experience being out, Wade Davis, who's a former professional football player in the NFL for the Washington Redskins, who talks about his experience. You know, I think that those avenues are, and those doors are opening up a lot more than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to see that. Just a few weeks ago, there was a professional boxer who came out, actually.
Yeah, love that.
A Puerto Rican boxer, I believe, too. So I think that obviously there are gay and lesbian professional athletes.
Right.
The question is whether they feel comfortable enough to be open about their sexuality.
Of course, yes, and we saw that in the Olympics. The few gay athletes, openly gay athletes there were very vocal and very, very wonderful to speak with. But you realize with 10,000-12,000 people there had to be more. I've seen that, and that was wonderful. Did you do the interviewing for that chapter coming out of the locker room?
No, I didn't. Rod McCollum, who was the writer of that piece for Coming Out in the Locker Room. And he's also the guy who runs the Rod 2.0 website or blog, which covers a lot of African-American LGBT issues.
Great, great. Andre St. Clair Thompson, one of the contributors, I'm sitting there reading it. I made a little note. I wanted to talk about it. You intervened in his life. You're like a major...
Yeah. Well, it wasn't intentional, but... years ago, I don't even remember exactly when, but some time ago, I gave a speech at Brown University, and he was a student at Brown University at that time, and he got my book, I believe, around that time, and took it home and was, I guess, reading it and accidentally left it out somewhere, where his father caught a glimpse of it. And he's Jamaican, and his father is Jamaican, and his father didn't approve of him reading the book. And he created this whole scene that becomes the focal point of his story. It was just such an interesting connection. His piece is called Many Rivers to Cross, which is based on the Jimmy Cliff reggae song, Many Rivers to Cross. And I just felt that it was just such a fascinating story in so many different layers and texture. And also the fact that he is a cross-dressing man himself was interesting.
Oh, interesting. The the book that he found, the book that he found was One More River to Cross. I thought that was interesting, too, the Black... Hello? You there?
Yes, I'm sorry. I missed the question, though. What was the question again?
The book that his father found, the one he had hidden, left out, was One More River to Cross.
That was my first book, One More River to Cross, exactly.
That's where the title came from, because there was a river in there.
Exactly. Lots of rivers crossing here.
Let me go do a plug for your book. You can for colored boys who have considered suicide when the rainbow is still not enough. Available on Amazon.com. Keith Boykin, Boykin. It's easy to find. He also has a website just for this book. On our show page, if you're listening in, it's for colored boys, the numeral 4, coloredboys.com. And so there will. Of the story you find most compelling?
Which of the stories did I find most compelling? Hello?
Yes. Yes. Hello, can you hear me? We're good?
Yeah. I think many of the stories are compelling. I think there's a story called Chicago by Phil Branch, which is a fascinating story about a man in Los Angeles, of all places, not in Chicago, who has to deal with a sexual encounter, if you will, for one of the first times. And it's just it's an amazing, I don't know if you had a chance to read that story, but it's just an amazing discussion about the way people are introduced to sexuality.
Right.
And some of the challenges that people face in dealing with that. And his story is just, it's almost unbelievable. It's scary, it's crazy, but it's real.
And that's the one with the cab driver or something.
What was that?
He meets a man and he drives him to his place far away to get home. He took a cab and didn't get charged. Is that the one where the cab driver helped him get home? Yeah.
Good story.
How did you find the contributors?
We put out a call for submissions, and in the course of the, we did it, I think, May of 2011, I want to say. Yeah, May of 2011. And in the course of doing so, we generated, I think, hundreds and hundreds of different people who submitted essays. And then we had a team of people, 4 people, who reviewed all the essays and made recommendations about which ones to include. They reviewed them on a number of different categories, including, which stories were most compelling, which stories fit into the book, which stories were best written. And there are some stories that weren't as well written as others, because not everybody here is a professional writer and author. But the stories were just so amazing. So when we identified them, I personally worked with several of the authors to help get their pieces into shape. But it was just a sort of an organic process.
Mm-hmm.
The irony or tragedy of this whole thing is that one of the people I'd hoped to serve as an editor for the book alongside me, a friend of mine from years ago, David Neal, who also went to Brown, actually. He had served as an assistant for me and been a friend of mine over the years. And before I could actually reach out to him to participate in the book project, I found that he, too, had taken his own life. And he left a suicide note in his car saying that he wanted to be cremated next to his mother. And it was just another reminder of why this is so important to have the story out there.
Sure, sure. And you know, we have, you know, and you deal with everything in these stories. You deal with everything from adolescence to college years to ageism. So it does have the full spectrum. You did capture the experience in these 44 stories. And it's an interesting comment you made that you put the call out in May of 2011, and here we are with a hard copy book that I've had here for a couple of months, actually, that Don sent me. And isn't it amazing? How has, in the few years since you've been publishing, how have things changed in the publishing world?
It's changed enormously. I mean, it's almost like night and day. I mean, I think the publishing industry is traditionally very slow anyway about adapting to change. But there were bookstores back in the day when my first book came out in 1996. So I went on a tour across the country to a lot of different cities and actually did some book signings at bookstores. But there aren't that many bookstores around anymore. And
right.
Independent bookstores are having difficulty. The African American bookstores, the LGBT bookstores are having difficulty. Not to mention the chain bookstores, which originally had swallowed up the independents, and now those are going out of business too. So you know, the e-technology and e-books and the availability of Kindle and so forth and the iPad, people are reading books in a different way. They're exposed to literature in a different way, and it's having an enormous impact on the entire industry and an enormous impact on writers as well.
Right, and self-publishing. It's kind of democratizing everything in one case, but also we're on internet radio, so I can say this, but there's also a lot of crap coming out because it's not being edited and it's not being looked at.
But there was a lot of crap coming out before. and even though it's more democratized and there's more people who have access to it, I think there's also probably the potential for more gems to be found, more diamonds in the rough, because having gatekeepers in the past, whether it's an agent, an editor, a publishing company, or so many people who stood in the way of having your ability to communicate to the public, having those people in the past and not having them as much now makes an enormous difference for somebody who does have a good story to tell and is a good writer, but just doesn't necessarily have the connections to be able to get published.
That's true. That's true. You are going to get kind of some underground genius is going to come through. All right, let's switch gears. You went to Harvard with President Obama, and I have the question: who got on Oprah first?
He did, because I've never been on Oprah. I think there's a misconception that I have, but I've been on other shows, but never on Oprah's show. There's another guy named J.L. King who wrote a book about the down low, and he was on the Oprah show. And for some reason, a lot of people think that I was as well, but he was on the show twice for some reason. The first time he talked about his book, the second time I think he kind of acknowledged that he wasn't completely truthful about some of the things he had said the first time. I don't understand. I love Oprah dearly. I have enormous respect for her. I think she does a wonderful job in teaching and educating. But on that one issue, I think she just didn't get it right. I think she gave a platform to somebody who had no knowledge, no facts, and nothing but a self-serving agenda to promote himself and his book. Did a great disservice, I think, to black women and black men as well in perpetuating the myth of the down low.
But I think he was just first, and it was such an attention grabber. You know, the whole idea, whether it was research well done or not, it just grabbed the attention. I'm sorry, for some reason I thought you had been. Oops, sorry. All right,
not the first person to make that assumption. Lots of people, people actually come up to me and say, "Oh, I loved you on Oprah," and I just laugh because I know I've never been on there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you would know. I think that's something you would know in your life, just like your gold medal at the Chicago Gay Games in 2006.
Which was such a fluke, too, because I decided, I think at the last minute, that I wanted to compete in the Gay Games in Chicago. And I think a month before the competition started, I decided I was going to do it. And I sent in the application or whatever. And a few days after I sent it in, I got a call from a colleague who asked me if I would be willing to speak at the Gay Games. And so I actually gave a speech at the Gay Games, at the opening ceremony, and that actually facilitated my whole participation in the wrestling competition there. But it was just kind of a message, I think, maybe the universe is telling me that this was a good idea to do. And I competed, and I hadn't done this. I hadn't competed in competitive. I hadn't done competitive wrestling in years, but not since I was in school. But I did it, and I lost the very first match by, I think, 1 point. And I thought that was going to be the end of it. I was ready to go home. And then they called me back and said, no, you have another chance to continue on. And I kept going and going and going and ended up winning gold medal, which I didn't think was even possible. So when they called my name, I was shocked because I thought that if you lost the first match, you couldn't win anything after that. But somehow I did.
Wrestling, is, those tournaments are strange. And this goes to show you the difference between you and I. I trained for like 2 years on that swimming competition. I was on a swim team. We did win gold then. But I am now already signed up for the 2014 Gay Games. I started martial arts like a couple of 3 years ago. And even though it's 2 years away, I'm like working 2 years ahead. But there are different, everyone's page, you know. So maybe we'll see, we'll run into each other there again. Who knows? But it's kind of fun. The Gay Games are interesting. I've had a lot of people tell me why do you have to have Gay Games anyway? Why, you know, you've got the Olympics, you've got all these sports competitions, you've got all these triathlons. Why do you need the Gay Games? And I answered.
Go ahead. I want to hear what you had to say.
I just think that the being around, unless you've ever been to the Gay Games or competed in the Gay Games, you just don't get it. It's so much more fun than the tension of a regular tournament or a marathon or a triathlon that's mixed with straights and gays. It's our little space. We can misbehave. We can, you know, we can move our hips funny. I mean, there's all sorts of antics going around, and you do let your hair down. You are totally relaxed. What are your thoughts?
I think that that's a good observation. It reminds me of the question that people always ask me, and I think someone asked me this when I gave a speech at SIU Carbondale, Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, a week ago or so, about black organizations as well, or black events. People often say to me, well, why do you need black events? Why can't we all just be human? Why do we have to acknowledge race? And people say the same thing about gays. Why do we need these gay groups? Why can't we all just compete in larger events and larger society? And the reality is that most of these institutions, organizations, and events started because it created a safe space for people when there was no safe space. And it created an opportunity for people when a lot of people who were gay or lesbian in that context, or African American in that context, didn't have an opportunity, when they were excluded, officially excluded from a lot of different places and spaces. So I think they still serve a valuable role. And yes, because of the way things have changed in our society, there are opportunities for people to compete in the actual Olympics without having to compete in the Gay Games. But there's nothing wrong with someone doing both. So I think it's good that we have opportunities for people to choose whatever it is, whatever path they want to follow.
And it's a second and third chance for a lot of people like me who was thrown into lockers and hid during gym class when I was going through it because of being gay and being picked on. So I blossomed later, and now I can compete. I can, you know, do something physical. And so it was a second chance for me. We have like 2 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about what needs to happen for African American gay men, young men.
What needs to happen? Well, I'm not sure that there's any one thing that needs to happen, but I think that if you read the book, there's a message that I try to communicate in the very last words of the book, and I try to communicate throughout the book, especially in my essay and the other pieces in there, and it's about love. I think that ultimately we need to experience more love, practice more love, and figure out ways to encourage other people to be more loving and self-loving. That we don't see enough of. If we can do that, I think ultimately it's far more important than political solutions, which are also important. But the answer to all this is about love.
Okay, great. That's good. All right, political prognostication. How are we going to be doing in the next 18 days?
Oh, this is a good question. I'm still thinking Obama's going to win the election. I just went through all the polls earlier today. He's leading in 6 of the 9 battleground states.
Right.
Even if the poll, even after the little shake he took from the first debate, he still has 294 electoral votes in the states he's leading in. So that's enough to win easily. So I think after his debate performance last week, and the upcoming debate on foreign policy, which is one of his areas of expertise, if you will.
Right.
I think he'll be fine in the election.
I agree with you.
Turn out to vote, that is. That's the issue, if they turn out to vote.
My last statement tonight is, everyone occupy the voting booth November 6th. We're going to be out there. Keith, it's been a total pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, Nathan. I appreciate it.
Good night. Thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
Good night. There we go.